Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. Our guest today is Guy Claxton, an internationally renowned writer, consultant, and academic specializing in creativity, education, and the mind. He's the author of more than 20 books, including the best-selling Building Learning Power. He's going to talk to us today about his latest book, Intelligence in the Flesh, Why Your Mind Needs Your Body Much More Than It Thinks. In the discussion, we explore some of the potential implications and ramifications of this perspective with regard to the role of the brain, emotions, the theory of embodied meaning, education and the arts, and dualisms such as subjectivity and objectivity, and facts and values. Hello, Guy. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, now, you suggest in the book, Guy, that human beings are fundamentally built for action and not particularly for thinking and or understanding. However, we're very much meaning-making creatures in the sense that we find opportunities to do things that matter. How then do we go about organising ourselves as an organism in order to make sense of the world in a meaningful way and act accordingly?
That's the foundational question, I think, from which I started with this book. I've been interested for some time in what you might call non-intellectual forms of intelligence. And I've come to think that we go wrong if we sort of put the cart before the horse. And the horse really is the perennial question that we all face every moment of our lives, which is, what's the best thing to do next? And as we grow up, that question gets more and more complicated because we perceive more and more opportunities in life. Our skills and our expertise expands. But also our portfolio of needs and wants and desires and goals also becomes more complicated and therefore potentially more conflicted. So resolving these three sets of factors, what you might call your needs or your concerns, what you're up to, what you're about, then your capabilities, what you are physically capable of doing about what might be of benefit to you or to anybody you care about.
Yeah.
And then meshing those with what in the embodied cognition literature is referred to as the affordances of the environment, the opportunities that are currently available to me. And the smarter I am, the better I am at coming up with an optimal resolution in real time to that question. And that doesn't mean acting impulsively in the moment, because some of my concerns are slow and long term. And sometimes they need to, so to speak, grab the steering wheel rather than the immediate lure of whatever happens to be passing under your nose. But the core of it is action. Is, as a lot of the neuroscientists are saying at the moment, the fact that we are built to act. We're not built to reflect or know or understand or theorize. These are tools. These are ancillary cognitive capabilities that have evolved to guide, to supplement, to add to the intelligence behind what do I do next. So putting doing at the middle of what we're about seems to me to be really critical.
And how do these, you have a sort of shorthand for these three things. You call them needs, deeds and seeds. How do they actually sort of communicate with each other in order to act?
Well, they start from the needs are in their origin and continue to be what our physiological needs are. And so those sources of information are profoundly visceral and somatic. But it's not just the needs of hunger or thirst or need for warmth or need for shelter, which engage us viscerally. As we grow up, according to Antonio Damasio and many other neuroscientists, all of our experiences are marked in terms of their relevance to our needs, and the root, the taproot of those needs, are in the body.
Right.
So we have to register those. Then we have to be aware through kinesthetic sense, through proprioception, of what our body is currently capable of doing, where my limbs are, how tired I am. All of those factors need to be represented. And then through what we call our special senses, I need to be aware of what's available. I might have a strong desire to fly to the moon, but I lack both the capabilities and the opportunity to do that. So it's a desire that's not worth wanting, you might say.
Yeah.
So all of these originate in different aspects of the organism. Crudely, the needs involve the viscera, the major organs of the body. The deeds, our capacity for deeds or our capabilities, involve the musculature and the ligaments of the body. And the seeds, the things that we can see possibilities for, involve the special senses. So they start from different aspects of the body. But in the twinkling of an eye, the way we're designed, those three sets of considerations are almost instantaneously reverberating with each other in our brains. When they come together in our brains, within tens of milliseconds, what we want is influencing what we see. The opportunities that we see is immediately influencing our readiness for action. So it's a mistake to see the integration of these three things as happening, so to speak, way down the line after we've thought or reflected, something like that. Or, as in many introductory psychology textbooks, that somehow perception and action are at the opposite end of some long conveyor belt of processing. On the contrary, they're all part of an instantaneous whirl that's going on in our brains and our bodies.
And different parts of the bodies, in relation to this, they communicate with each other directly, don't they? You talk about the heart has its own sort of little brain, in a sense. It's got its own neurons.
Yes. What we've missed in thinking about the body is, and what many other venerable traditions haven't missed, although they map it in ways that may or may not relate to contemporary science, what we've missed is the fact that the major characteristic of the body is that it is a constant maelstrom of information streams, of different bits of the body talking to each other. And as you say, many of them talking to each other directly. People talk about the heart having a nervous system, having a brain of its own. The heart talks directly via the endocrine system to the digestive system and to the immune system. The changes in muscular tension influence what's going on in our eyes or in our viscera. We know that having a walk after a heavy meal helps the digestive process. Physical activity impinges directly on what's going on in our guts. So there's lots of lateral communication going on between the different bits of the body.
And from this perspective then, what role does the brain play? What is the traditional view of how the brain works, and how does this perspective challenge that?
Traditionally, the brain is seen somehow as being the chief executive of our being or our psyche or our persona, as if the brain were the place where intelligence lived, and mostly our intelligence manifested in some kind of inner agent, which we could call the ego or let's call it the brain these days. Is the place that is fed information. It decides what to do on the basis of that information, and then it issues commands to the musculature. That's one way of looking at the brain, and it's a way which preserves a kind of brain-mind on the one hand, body on the other, split. It allows us to persist with the idea that intelligence inheres in what we used to think of as the soul, or and then we called it the mind. But now we've neuroscientists in the 20th century located the mind closely with the brain. But nevertheless, there was a continuation of a kind of split between what was going on above this line, which was smart and intelligent and reflective and well-informed, and what was going on below that line, which was rather menial, which was merely the carrying out of orders. Now, what emerges from the work that I and many other people have been doing is a view of the brain not as the command center of the mind-brain-body system, but as a place where all the different voices in the body, the visceral voices, the somatic voices, the voice of the skin, the voice of the eyes, the voice of the nostrils, the voice of the musculature, the voice of the immune system, can all come together and, so to speak, be represented at the decision-making table.
Right.
Which is what the brain is. The brain is the place where those different concerns, capabilities, and senses of opportunity can be resolved into an answer to the question, what's the best thing to do next? So the brain isn't, as it were, some kind of smart agent separate from all these other voices or forms of information. The brain is the place where it's like the parliament. The brain is like the houses of parliament. There is no chief executive in parliament. Well, at least when parliament works well, it works like a moot. It works like a conclave where people get together and thrash things out. But the brain is capable of doing that in the twinkling of an eye. It doesn't take a week and the length of time it might take to elect a new pope in the conclave in the Vatican. But nevertheless, the brain works on the same kind of principle. So there is no need, and indeed there is no evidence for the existence of some separate bit of the brain, whether you call it the frontal lobes or the prefrontal cortex or whatever it might be, which is the smart bit that is digesting all everybody else's information and then deciding what to do. And I think that's a major revolution in our sense of the way we function, the architecture of intelligence, if you like. And it's something that makes us take seriously the idea that the body is an intrinsic, dynamic, continual aspect of our intelligence, not merely a vehicle for getting our intelligent mind from place to place.
So as you say, the entire body then is in effect the organ of intelligence.
Absolutely. That's the way I would prefer to put it. And more than that, the body plus aspects of the environment, that our intelligence doesn't just stop at the edges of our skin.
So it's an interaction between the two then, yeah?
Yes, because through our bodies, we sense what's going on in the world around us, not just in terms of vision and sound, smell, taste, pressure on our skin, the detection of pheromones, a puff of wind, whatever's coming into us is what connects us to the world. So the skin needs to be seen not as a barrier, but as it were, the trading boundaries of the trading edges of the bodily system, which is always what connects us to the world around us. If we don't stay connected, if someone tapes up my mouth and my nostrils and disconnects me from the air around me, I'm not going to last very long. And exactly the same thing is true for the informational exchange that's going on through the skin and the eyes and the nose.
Yeah. And this brings in the notion of tools as well. That's an integral part of who we are in many ways.
Many people have argued that we've evolved very smartly, not uniquely in the animal kingdom by any manner of means, but preeminently to be on the lookout for ways of amplifying our own psychophysical intelligence with all kinds of resources around us. We create tools and we accumulate tools which enable us to act like the plugins to your computer. to, you know, like a plug-in hard drive or a plug-in printer, they all become part of the same system. You can't say it's just the computer that's intelligent, because my computer can't do anything on its own unless it's plugged in to the printer. I couldn't be having this conversation with you if it wasn't also connected to the eyes of its camera. So we need to be seeing the fact that even the brain sense of the body, where it is and where it ends, is flexible. When I pick up a tool, when I pick up this pen, my brain immediately adjusts my body image so that the extremity is now not at the end of my finger, but it's at the end of the pen. Blind person's stick, the tip of their stick through which they feel the world, literally becomes, in terms of the way the brain functions, a part of the body. So we need to make sure that we have an extended view of our own intelligence as well as an embodied view.
One of the earlier hominids was called Homo habilis. In some ways, do you think that is perhaps a more appropriate term for us than Homo sapiens?
Well, we are sapiens, but we are absolutely ecological beings. A spiritual teacher used to use with great passion the phrase, we are built open. We are built, as it were, to be constantly not just informed by the world, but formed by the world. We are world resonating beings. It's like Alan Watts used to say, you know, you can see an eddy in the river, but it has no existence of its own. If you try and take the eddy home in a bucket, you'll be disappointed. And we are like that. I'm constantly being, so to speak, whipped into shape, literally and cognitively, by my interactions with the world around me. So yes, I think it makes much more sense for us to see ourselves not as little isolated beings that need to become related to the world, that forms relationships with the world, but that is right from the get-go intrinsically related, intrinsically interactional. That's the nature of our being.
Yeah, so there's this constant process then of mutual causality, a bit like the hummingbee's bill and the length of the flower. They're inextricably linked, in a sense, with their environment.
Yes, absolutely. And we are involved in what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing the whole time. But you don't have to interpret that mystically.
No.
You can interpret it simply basically in terms of basic physics, if you like.
Sure, yeah.
When I'm having a conversation with a real human being who's in my vicinity, my brain waves are being affected, becoming entrained. And because my brain is becoming entrained, so are all kinds of aspects of my body. We know that if I mimic your gestures, you become more open to me, you become more trusting of me. So we need to see ourselves in that light, absolutely.
Sure. So, okay, well, this brings me to my next question. What are emotions for?
Well, in the old way of thinking about human beings, emotions were seen as somehow antithetical or in conflict with our intelligence. If you locate intelligence as being either in the brain or in some higher faculty like the soul or the mind or rationality, and you locate emotions in the body, then you're led to a view which says there's a constant tension, a constant conflict. You're led to the view that has dogged us through 2,000 years of Western civilization, of seeing that somehow or other we are essentially born in conflict with ourselves. An emotion is constantly threatening, lusty, willful, wild emotion is constantly threatening to subvert our fallible but precious rationality. That view of the mind goes from Plato through Descartes to Freud and on through many religions into the present day. But if you take a more biological view, then you see the emotions as being evolved assets which are designed to set our system in a whole variety of different ways into a preparedness to respond to the world in the light of certain events as interpreted by our systems. If I see a dangerous looking predator looming up, or even the shadow passes, a large shadow passes over me, then I experience what we call fear. But what that experience is a very rapid readying of myself to flee, or to defend myself, or to burrow under a stone, or to do whatever. It's like we are set like a whole lot of different aspects of ourselves, our attention, our musculature, our memory access, our energy resources are all set in the light of that apprehension of what we might be about to need to do in order to ensure our own survival.
Yeah.
So emotions are deeply intelligent. They are absolutely born out of and constantly informing this, the perennial question of what's the best thing to do next. Of course, they can go wrong. Of course, socialization can lead us to become frightened of things that are not really scary, or to become frightened of things that are actually vital to our well-being. Someone who's been through a difficult, painful breakup of a relationship might walk away from that with a lifelong fear of intimacy. That's not going to serve us well in the long run. It served us well in the short term, but maybe not so well in the long run. So we need to see our rationality, our ability to cogitate and to reflect, as being, as it were, fine tuning of these fundamentally intelligent settings which the basic emotions provide for us.
And then you mentioned Antonio Damasio earlier on. I found one of his experiments that was particularly striking was that when he did studies on people that, for one reason or another, their emotional centers of where the brain processes emotion, they were knocked out by a lesion or stroke or whatever. And these people, they didn't know what to want. They couldn't set goals. This idea that you can separate reason and emotion is not only is very unhelpful, it's extremely inaccurate, isn't it?
Yeah, Antonio Damasio refers to emotions or intuitions as the glue that stitches together our action and our intention, if you like. And without that glue, we can remain very clever. His experiments have shown that people with damage to certain areas of their prefrontal cortex, after they've recovered from the trauma, show no deficit at all on pencil and paper tests of their intelligence. They remain as clever as they ever were. But in their dealings with the world and with other people, they have become profoundly stupid. They don't know what to want. They don't know how to respond in real situations, in real time. So you see, as it were, the potential for a shearing apart of cleverness and a deeper, more fundamental kind of intelligence. And I sometimes think, I used to challenge my students by saying that education seems to have induced that kind of lesion in many of us. That's to say, we've become identified with cleverness at the expense of a deeper, more functional, more ecological form of intelligence. And you can see, you could argue more broadly in our society, that forms of disembodied rationality get us into as much trouble as they help us get out of.
Could we just move on now a little bit to the idea of meaning, especially in an embodied sense? I'm thinking of the work of Lakoff and Johnson, and as you know, their theory is that the meaning both of language and of non-linguistic symbols is processed through the neural links made in active physical experience, and not through a mental representation of objects referred to by language. How does that tie into all this, what we've been talking about?
People have often thought that language and the kinds of explicit forms of logical reasoning that language or symbol systems make available lives in some separate mental universe from the rest of our physiology. But a lot of recent work has shown that there are no separate language areas in the brain. Neurologists used to talk about Broca's area and Wernicke's area as if they were separate and distinct aspects of the brain. But actually, Broca's area is physiologically indistinct from areas of the brain that control physical hand gestures, for example, that exert fine control over many much broader aspects of our own muscular expertise. While Wernicke's area at the rear of the temporal lobes is equally engaged in sensory processing as it is in linguistic processing. So we need to see that language not only emerges from our sensory motor, physiological, needs-driven being. Obviously, we couldn't get started with language if milk didn't mean something significant to us, or mama didn't mean something deeply, viscerally important to us. But a lot of this research is showing that when we understand language now, even as sophisticated, rational adults, the sensory motor aspects of the brain are instantaneously, necessarily involved in interpreting the meaning of what's being said to us. In one series of studies, for example, the functioning of people's brains was observed in MRI machines whilst they were given different sentences to process, and they had to perform a small task on the sentences. But the critical fact is, when you show someone a sentence which says, John held the hammer, the bit of the brain that is responsible for grasping by the hand automatically lights up.
Yeah.
But even much more interesting than that, when you present someone with the sentence, John held a strong opinion, the same part of the brain lights up. We can't stop ourselves cashing out our abstract concepts or our metaphorical usages in terms of the physical, visceral origins which gave rise to them in the beginning. The work of Lakoff and Johnson has shown in great detail how our language, even our abstract language, even mathematics, is saturated with metaphors that have their roots in physical, concrete, practical, visceral reality. However clever, however rational or abstract we are, we never get away. We still, like the lotus, have the roots of those understandings still go down into the rich, muddy bottom of our own visceral experience.
Imagine the recognition of this can have enormous repercussions. I mean, we've been talking about the mind, body, reason, emotion splits. Does this view of the body also challenge other dichotomies like objectivity and subjectivity and facts and values?
Yes, obviously it does. You know, we're built to integrate our needs, our deeds and our seeds, our concerns, our capabilities and our circumstances. And it's a very useful, very, very useful, but very difficult trick to learn as to how to process information which now decouples those systems, which are designed evolutionarily to be strongly coupled with each other.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can do it through education and through language. We can achieve relative degrees of decoupling. We can become, like the judiciary, more and more dispassionate. We can bracket off for the time being whether in our hearts we're a leaver or a remainer when it comes to Britain's place with respect to the European Union. But when we sit in our high court, we are able, as it were, to achieve a temporary functional disconnection between what we want and a much broader or more dispassionate appraisal of the pros and cons of a situation. But it's a late trick and it's a complex trick to be able to do that. And once we've done that, our natural elasticity draws us back again to our embodiment. People who live entirely cerebral lives tend neither to be very happy nor very effective in the big wide world.
To what extent does all this also potentially put the arts back into a central place in meaningful human life, puts religion and science in a much less dualistically opposed position to each other, and pulls the rug perhaps from under the feet of metaphysical beliefs by depriving them of their founding assumptions about the meaning of language they depend upon?
The implications of this point of view are and the ramifications go very, very broadly into the institutions of our cultures and our societies, and into basic polarities or dualisms, like, for example, objectivity and subjectivity. In the way that I've been talking about them, there are forms of objectivity which attempt to bracket out, as a lawyer might or as a psychotherapist might, to bracket out their own current portfolio of self-referenced needs. But the idea that somehow or other subjectivity and objectivity, mind and body, reason and emotion, are somehow come from different realms and are in constant opposition, are constantly having to engage in some kind of combat or warfare with each other, that I'm afraid is a conception of human nature and a conception of certain forms of philosophical discourse which have had their day.
You were talking about education earlier. Now, arguably, you are principally an educationist, aren't you? I think that's your main vocation in a sense.
I'm trained as what they call a cognitive scientist. But a lot of my work over the last 40 years or so has been working pragmatically in the context of education, particularly in the context of school, yes.
Yeah, and was that, applying this and understanding of how we function, one of the main motivations for writing the book?
I'm very concerned about education and about some of the, what I think are mistaken or skewed assumptions that underpin, even to this day, the way in which education and the way in which schools are constructed. You just have to look at the timetable in an average secondary school to realize that the more body is involved in a particular subject or discipline or activity, the lower down it comes in the hierarchy of esteem amongst different subjects. Mathematics, which has been seen to be the most cerebral, the most divorced from the irritating particularities of experience, occupies its place at the top of the greasy pole of esteem, while dance and drama and physical education, unless, of course, you're winning tournaments, then, yeah. Then the esteem becomes slightly more complicated. But in day-to-day terms, those are the Cinderella subjects of the school curriculum. A GCSE, an educational qualification, is valued less in drama or in craft or technology than a GCSE in English or mathematics. And the amount of time given to them on the curriculum, when you can voluntarily drop these subjects, all reflect a lowering of esteem, which, when you take a more embodied view of intelligence, there's no obvious difference between the sophistication, the complexity, the amount of care and thought and subtlety that goes into the work of a lawyer or a professor of philosophy. There's no difference in kind between the sophisticated intelligence that they deploy and that which is deployed by a carer in an old folks' home,
exactly,
or
yeah,
someone who makes furniture for a living.
Yeah.
If we get over this blinkered apartheid, this disparity of esteem that's been forced on us by an inaccurate view of the relationship between mind and body, then many forms of unsung occupation begin to reemerge as highly worthy of our respect and our esteem, and not just those that are hung on the walls of internationally famous art galleries or that take place in concert halls, but many forms of embodied intelligence now reemerge as equal of our esteem as forms of intelligence as those which involve conscious, rational argument or writing.
You mentioned earlier, you were talking about neck up and neck down. I think that in the States, that's actually, it's a horrible term to actually describe certain types of job. It's a neck up job or a neck down job. And
even the colour of your collar seems to indicate the amount of intelligence that is involved. Whether you have a brown collar job, a blue collar job, or a white collar job, the collar, and it's the collar that signifies the apparent gap, isn't it, between the intelligent head and the dumb body.
Yeah, and so just in practical terms, what do we need to do in our schools and how difficult will that be? You know, this Cartesian view that is still very much out there, how do we start to chip away at that?
Well, I think there are lots of things that I would like to see in schools. The first is a high status curriculum about embodied cognition. I think children would be fascinated to learn much more about how their bodies communicate with each other and how intelligent resolutions of complex predicaments come about in an embodied way. So I would want to see, if I ruled the world, if I was Secretary for State for Education or Minister of Education in some country or other, I would want to push for an embodied neuroscience as being a core part of the curriculum, a core aspect of our understanding of ourselves, both individually and socially. But I would also want to see in schools a much greater recognition of the importance of forms of physical activity that build what in the literature is called interoceptive awareness, that develops our own sensibility to our own internal functioning. Because we know from the research, from Damasio's research and others, that people who are more sensitive to their own internal process act more intelligently in everyday life. People who are able to gauge their own heart rate without the use of a device or without putting their fingers on their pulse perform better in various real-life complex problem-solving or decision-making scenarios. People who are less sensitive or who through psychopathology or even sometimes through depression become less sensitive to what's going on inside their own bodies become less able to function intelligently in the world around them. So forms of exercise like yoga, like Tai Chi, forms of exercise that invite a greater awareness of what's going on in your muscles, in your viscera, in your skin, within your body. I would like to see those forms of exercise valued in schools just as much as what's going on the rugby field or the tennis court.
Yeah, and meditation?
And indeed forms of meditation, absolutely.
Okay. And then taking this to a wider perspective, how can this view of our bodies affect potentially our social, civic and spiritual lives?
A lot of our institutions, not only education, are built on this naive or inadequate assumption that intelligence exists in words and thought and not in bodily engagement. Our judicial systems, for example, are built on the idea that somehow or other justice will emerge from a kind of combative, argumentative discourse between two highly articulate advocates of particular positions. Our politics works again on this kind of the assumption that verbal adversary, that a kind of verbally adversarial form of ritualized combat that we see in the House of Commons day after day, that somehow these are the best ways of wisely governing our societies. In many traditional societies, it was very important for people to eat together, to break bread together, to walk together, to dance together even, and in order to achieve a more harmonious and a deeper, and I would say more intelligent, resolution of some of these issues. So there are profound implications for the way in which we configure business, law, politics, the esteem for the arts, many aspects of our cultural and civic lives have enshrined this false dichotomy between mind and body. And I would very much hope that this new research will act as a solvent, will soften up those polarities which have become embodied in our social and civic lives.
Okay. And okay, for us in our society, I mean, our middle way society, Guy, the middle way is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, whether those are positive or negative. That then throws us back on experience. So we're left in this messy, visceral, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in this messy, uncertain middle that we actually start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. How might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Yes, I think we, you know, it's unfortunate that we're not born with a manual about how to deal with all the tricky things that come at us in life. And the attempt to try and figure things out with language, with symbol systems, with spreadsheets and databases, to use the language of language and the language of mathematics to try and resolve all those tricky dilemmas, turns out to be not the best way of engaging with those situations. We need to be embodied. We need to be back in our bodies so that when we're making those decisions, we're not just relying on the kinds of caricatures of the world which are served up to us through conscious forms of language. Language is such a crude tool in terms of representing the complex, shifting whirlpool of experience, both the sediment of experience in our own minds and brains and bodies, but also the maelstrom of experience that is impacting on us throughout our lives at every moment. If we try and cope with our lives only in terms of the crude caricatures which language provides, it's no wonder that we often miss the mark. The only way, really, to be truly intelligent is to live with what Alan Watts called the wisdom of insecurity, to become more and more comfortable with the fact that it's a make-it-up-as-you-go-along world. And the more in touch we are with the nature of the world, both inside us and outside us, the better able we will be to make it up as we go along.
Yeah. Okay. And what's your greatest hope for the book, Guy?
Oh, my greatest hope for the book is that it sells in tens and hundreds of thousands and makes me a wealthy man and I can retire to a beach house in a warm part of the world. But I just hope that it will add something to a public discourse which will move in the direction of a greater reconciliation, a greater unification of all that we are, of mind and body. I would hope that I could add a little bit. Quite a lot of what is currently available discussing the research in embodied cognition is of quite a technical and quite an abstruse nature, and however adequately I've managed to achieve this goal, I think the work is so important that it deserves to be got out there in the way that Freud's work got out there, the idea of the unconscious. I think we need to get these ideas out there so that they can begin to inform the public discourse that we live in, and then begin to seep back more and more deeply, not just into our intellectual understandings, but into our embodied understandings of our embodied existence.
Okay, well, I think from reading the book, Guy, I think you've added a lot to the discussion, and I especially valued the synthetic approach you took in the book and put all these things together. For any of the listeners out there, I would highly recommend the book. And it's been a great pleasure talking to you today, Guy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a great pleasure for me too. Thank you for such an interesting and well-informed set of questions. It was a real pleasure. And I'm now very happy to be in the same company as my good friend Stephen Batchelor, with whom I had dinner last week. So I'm happy to be now become a member of the Middleway podcast fraternity.
Oh, lovely.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.